Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Oak Park, Michigan, and dropped out of high school at age 16. For the past 30 years, he has owned all the abandoned buildings on three square blocks in downtown Detroit. And in 1979, he bought the 1897-era James Scott Mansion for $4,600 and is currently turning it into 27 condos. He's a street-taught banker, developer, lawyer, economist, and psychologist who, after 40-plus years, has become an overnight genius. His name, Joel Andy. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Rasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Joel Andy, who was a genius for 40 years before any of us knew it. Joel, welcome. We're real honored to have you.
Thank you very much. I'm honored to be here.
Can we start by talking about what were you like, Landy, as a kid?
As a kid? Well, a few things, I guess, kind of shaped my life. One, I am very thankful to my family that I was exposed to most everything. They sent me to art camp and computer camp and music camp. So being exposed to many things was very helpful. I had, as a child and still do, a long-term chronic illness, Crohn's disease. So that actually had its, although very hard living with it, had its own benefits in that I never knew if I was going to be sick tomorrow. So I had to get everything done in my life that day. So my life was always kind of high pressure, even as a five-year-old. I think I learned to worry when I was born. You know, things as silly as you're on, as a young child, and I'm driving in the car with my mother, and I start worrying about, oh no, when I'm able to drive, how am I going to figure out where I'm going? This is as a five-year-old. So that kind of stuff really kind of drove me and helped shape my life.
Okay, figuring out where you're going. At age 16, you drop out of Cass Tech in the 11th grade. Why?
Cass Tech was probably at that time the best school in the area. There were 5,000 students. I had come from Oak Park, so it was a real awakening. I saw the world, and that probably was one of the problems. School, I had such a mix of knowledge that I had to sit through 5 days of everything that I knew to find 10 minutes of something I didn't know to learn it. So that was actually one of the other big things as a young child that shaped it. I continually would complain to my mother, Mom, I'm bored. So I don't get bored anymore. I have filled my life.
In 1969, you moved to Chicago. And you go to work for an alternative paper, the Chicago Seed. And the entire Seed staff lived in this $200 a month townhouse on LaSalle Street, where activists Abby Hoffman, Tom Hayden, etc., would show up. Talk about those days, late 60s, early 70s in Chicago.
That was a very high-powered time, really, all over the country. Detroit, San Francisco, New York, Chicago. I think 1967, 68, 69, all of the people that were involved in community organizing and politics and music and alternative lifestyles were living 100 lives a year. I did so many things each year of being in a business and living in San Francisco and then working in another city. Just, it moved so fast, and the experiences were they were so well-rounded, from education to doing the right thing to just really important to give a sense of community. And so I guess what I learned later on, actually as this President Obama was being elected the first time, they're talking about him as a Chicago community organizer, which is actually how I grew up. I moved to Chicago, as you said, in 1969, and that was ostensibly to work on the trial, the conspiracy trial for the Chicago Seven. Some of the people that you named, where the government said that these seven people were trying to overthrow the government. It was right during the Democratic convention of that year, 1968, and there was a riot in the streets, and the Chicago government, the Mayor Daley, the father at that time, and the police were rather on the right side of every issue, and they and the left side did not get along, so there was a riot, and then the trial came from that. And no internet, so it really was the printed word. And our job, it was so ridiculous, our job was to make a circus out of the trial, which I think we succeeded.
All right, 1972, you moved back to Detroit, and you had one talent where you could fix foreign cars.
That's true. A few short stops on the way, a nightclub in the Pickford Shelby Hotel, which is now renovated, a little business with videotaping, a print shop in Ann Arbor in the basement of the Blind Pig in cooperation with some community organizers in Ann Arbor. And then I was driving, as you said, foreign cars. I was driving British sports cars. I had a couple of MGs and couldn't afford to have them fixed, so I taught myself how to fix them. And through time, other people I met had a car and they needed it fixed. And it was also the time when the law in the state of Michigan was being written and enacted to govern licensing of auto mechanics. So I rented a building and started fixing cars and continued for more than 25 years, which was really a very rewarding trade, but also gave me the resources to be able to purchase all of the land and buildings that were surrounding my house in the Cass Corridor.
We're talking to Joel Landy, who's a tall, hippie version of Einstein. When we come back, we're going to ask him what the Cass Corridor was in the early 70s. And I'm Jack Rasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Crisula, and we're with Joel Landy, who currently owns 14 businesses and is a street-taught banker, developer, lawyer, economist, and psychologist who, after 40 years, has become an overnight genius. Joel, the Cass Corridor back in the 70s when you moved there.
The first part of it is I love the title to your show, Anything Is Possible, because that was really one of the watchwords of the day and still is. In order to achieve anything that I did in that area, and a small group of us achieved in what is now called Midtown, we had to have that principle that you never accept no for an answer, which leads right into Anything Is Possible. So the Cass Corridor was a transient neighborhood since the Industrial Revolution, since the early 1900s. First, it was immigrants moving in, and later on, it became more of economic, poverty-driven. The housing was very cheap. Then welfare and general assistance. We had the birth of the slumlords, which were documented by Chuck Costa, if anyone remembers. He ran for mayor 3 or 4 times against Coleman Young, owned a paint store on Grand River, and had a book ghostwritten about him called Slumlord that he was very proud of. So the Cass Corridor was a large number of neglected Victorian buildings that were used as transient housing. There were probably 5 businesses left, a lot of vacant space, a lot of buildings that were left and truly abandoned, and then some large institutions, the medical center at the time, the large hospitals, Wayne State University, General Motors was nearby. But I found that what happened in Cass Corridor was typical in many large cities. Just right outside of downtown was this wasteland that was similar to the Cass Corridor. And being vacant, negative influences found it an easy place to hang out. The crime could take place because it was so vacant, no one was watching. Of course, on the other side of that coin, I was happy because it gave myself and my friends freedoms we couldn't have in other cities because no one was watching.
There was a belief, Joel, a perception, that the Cass Quarter was the most crime-filled neighborhood in America.
That's a very important part of how we changed the Cass Quarter into what everyone knows as Midtown today. It's true. If you were in 1979, if you were in Paris, France, and you were wearing a Cass Quarter T-shirt, people would run away from you. It was known throughout the world as the worst area in the world, but it was mostly perception. The 13th Precinct, which was the police area that was the Cass Quarter, was actually the safest precinct in the city, and commanders in the police department were transferred there before they retired so they wouldn't have any trouble and would have an easy life on the way out to retirement. There were a lot of heroin addicts, a lot of prostitution, and I guess for the rest of us, it didn't influence us because those people attacked each other. And those crimes mostly went underreported, of course. But we did numerous studies when there was no money here. There were no mortgages. There was no money. There was no building in Detroit. And so during that time, at least we were planning what we would do if we did have money. And one of the things we learned was that crime was the perception, not the reality. So the two things that, aside from crime and cleanliness that we worked on for years in the Cass Quarter, the two big things that changed the map, that made it all possible, that probably 10 of us pushed very hard and made happen, were, one, changing the perception. When we changed the name from Cass Quarter to Midtown, all of a sudden it was acceptable to live and work in Midtown. Now, you Google anything, a map or Yahoo or any location, and you'll see Midtown on all the maps. It's known as Midtown throughout the world. So just changing that perception had an overnight positive effect. The other one was, for a very long time in this vacant neighborhood, aside from being easy for crime and other elements to find a home in this vacant area, it also is an area where the government and certain nonprofits thought we could gather all of the people in need in one space, and then we wouldn't need any way to transport them, and every service would be right here. Unfortunately, the over-concentration of any use has a negative effect. So we were, in fact, building a concentration camp in the Cass Corridor. In fact, in 1991, I and a few others wrote and lobbied and enacted a homeless shelter zoning ordinance. I woke up one day in about 1991, there were 11 homeless shelters within 3 blocks of my house. So all of that comes down to the improvements that we were able to do and to make life better for everyone. There was really no one to pay for helping these people. So we realized to have an economy in the former Cass Quarter in Midtown, we needed to subsidize what's called the market rate. We needed to subsidize and bring people to live here that had money to spend, extra money after their rent and their food and their basic necessities were taken care of. Then we'd have stores to shop in, we'd be able to hire people, we would have an economy and a city again. So the two things, changing the perception and bringing in people with spendable income, changed the day and built what is today Midtown, I think probably the most expensive and most active real estate in Michigan.
You were a John the Baptist for 40 years in the desert trying to convince people that this was the future of this Cass Quarter Midtown was spectacular. And Joel, nobody would listen to you for 40 years. Where did you get the courage, the chutzpah, the craziness to keep preaching that message?
Okay, first, you just went two ways on that, but I'm glad you explained the John the Baptist story because having my parents being Jewish, I wasn't totally familiar with the story. So that was very helpful. But to me, it was obvious. I looked at it and I saw these once beautiful Victorian buildings that cost millions of dollars to replicate today. I saw the proximity to all of these large institutions, the university, the medical center. Of course, all of that sounds really smart, and you keep saying genius, but none of it started like that. The real way it started was I stayed over a friend's house after the bar one night in the Cass Corridor on Peterborough. Couldn't get home to Oak Park. So when I woke up, he had three houses that he owned, all right next to each other, and he had fenced off so all the backyards were connected. He had a swimming pool back there. It was really a wonderful life, and I learned and saw what it would be like to have an area where you had no neighbors telling you what to do. So for probably 10 or 15 years, that was really part of the prime motivation, to create an area where my friends could come and live and have freedoms that they needed to be creative and to not have people telling us what to do. You couldn't leave a tractor on your front lawn in Birmingham.
In 1979, Joel Andy, you bought the 1897-era James Scott Mansion. Tell us about what that is today.
The James Scott Mansion was the house of the James Scott that we have a fountain on Belle Isle. He donated money for a monument of himself, the Scott Fountain. Same guy. This was his house. I think he was never able to live there. He started building it. It's about, it looks like a castle. It's about 100 feet wide, but it only goes 20 feet back. The person with the land behind him would not sell him the land. So this became what's known as a spite house. And he was a rich playboy, gambler, didn't get along with city government, but was very generous with all of the residents and gave to charities. So he built a solid brick wall with no ornamentation and no windows facing south downtown, the government and the neighbor that wouldn't sell him any land. I don't think he was ever able to live in the house because it was 20 feet deep. Maybe it was a brothel for a few years, but somewhere around 1910, Scott had died, and someone else bought it, built an addition on the back, and renamed it the Scott Apartments. And it continued, of course, one small part of that was with the Scott Fountain I mentioned earlier. The city had the bequest to build this monument on Belle Isle, but it was of Scott, and they didn't want to build a monument to someone that they had these problems with. Turned out, eventually, they accepted the money, built the monument, and put his name on the back of the fountain, where it is today.
We're talking to Joel Andy, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Crisula, and we're with a modern-day prophet, Joel Andy. Joel, most people quit before they even hear the word no. You have heard the word no thousands of times when you've pitched things. And you said in the previous segment, never accept no for an answer. Talk to people about the word no.
That short saying really has been one of the things that has helped me be successful and really describes or something that a lot of Detroiters do. The Detroiters that are happy here, are successful here, know that they can't accept no for an answer. But another big part of that is believing in what you're talking about. You're not accepting no for an answer because you believe what you're saying is right. So then, especially as experiences help people learn, you realize that you have to educate the people that are telling you no to try and bring them over to your way of thinking, to try and make what you see as right possible. So that never accepting no is just the first part of it.
Another part of the culture of Detroit is, because of the automotive, everything is, I want new. And when you got an old building, it's got to go.
That has been a major problem. I used to think all kinds of political theories of White Floyd and Coleman Young and oppressors' buildings, none of which were true, all which were way too complicated. It was exactly as you pointed out. In Detroit, more than anywhere else in the world, we were taught to buy a new car every year. new toaster, new house. We were immigrants. We had nothing. Plus, the marketing that developed influenced us, as I said, here more than anywhere else. We had a law during the young days on the books that said, it wasn't even the building code, it was city code, that if you renovated a building more than 50% of its value, then you had to build it like a new building. That was many, many times impossible. I went in with the Edison Apartments, and the city told me to tear it down. I knew that they didn't do that in the rest of the world. So I kept working with it, and 18 months later, I was able to show the buildings department the sections of the code that made it possible, and thereafter made it possible to renovate the buildings on Lower Woodward, the dime stores and the jewelry store and all of our great structures that were built in the 20s when we were the richest city. So a big thing has been the education. There was another group of people, historians, some government people, myself, community activists that got together probably 30 years ago and said we have to change the way the government and the residents view historic preservation.
For the last 30 plus years, Joel Landy has owned all the abandoned buildings on three square blocks in downtown Detroit. Some people refer to that as Landy Land. Let's talk about a few. The James Scott 1879 era mansion. What are you doing with that?
The James Scott Mansion had been vacant after a few fires since the early 1980s. I had been watching it being in my historic district that I had created in 1984, as being one of the most significant buildings in the worst condition. It had several fires in the roof, and through the next 20, 30 years, the building continued to collapse. It would be brought before city council to demolish, and I would be there to object and to save it. At that time, we didn't have a law where the city could sue an owner for back taxes and then claim the building. So in the mid-1980s, Sewer Traeger, one of the higher-up people in our city law department, wrote that ordinance. It was adopted, and eventually by the early 90s, the city had sued the former owner of the James Scott Mansion and took it into city ownership. At that time, I had a lot of support from the city council and the administration because I had been campaigning so long, and in the meantime, I had learned a very important part of my business that was to follow, and that was how to borrow money. So I had invested to date probably $35, $40 million I had borrowed in renovating all the other buildings surrounding the Scott. So I prepared the plans and all of the documentation, and then 2008 happened and the world collapsed. I was ready to walk in the buildings department for a permit to renovate the Scott and to make it into 27 condominium apartments. They'll be leased for a number of years because of the historic tax credit funding that was used to help renovate the building. So it collapsed, and I was able to put it back together. Financial institutions were again working in Detroit. And having done that whole series of steps that we took, I talked about earlier in raising the appraisals and subsidizing the market rate, since we had done that, we knew how to do that very quickly again. And from 2008, by 2012, the prices were back up to where they were. The economy was real again. And I was able to borrow $6 million. And the building had collapsed down to the first floor, and it's a three-story building. And it's all hand-cut, beautiful limestone of five different types and colors. So I borrowed this $6 million and put the package together and hired a bunch of people, and the building now is probably 3 or 4 months from completion. The front is, I can't even remember that it was all gone because it's all back and it looks just like it did in 1897.
1991, you buy the Jefferson School from the Detroit Public School System for $1,000. Tell us what that is today.
The Jefferson School, Sheldon, and the Lodge Freeway, it was a 110,000 square foot building, and the board at that time was being responsible and had signed a contract to tear it down for $450,000. I considered it an asset, and I considered it a total waste of money to pay to take away one of our assets. So I got into discussions with the school board, and it was too expensive to operate to buy from them. Then they were tearing it down. Then I heard someone else was going to buy it. And based on the hard work I was doing to rebuild Midtown with the types of institutions, businesses that were going to stimulate the economy and support the people and improve the quality of life, I acted like a private land bank in owning the building so I could channel it into a good use. Well, for 10 years, I fixed 900 windows. I took in a partner because I only had $500 of that $1,000. 900 windows and pumped out the water in the basement every month and electrically heated the roof drains until the Supreme Court in Michigan affirmed the charter school law. And in one trip, Edison Schools out of New York with Deborah McGriff, their employee who was here for a short time as our superintendent of schools, said, we'll take it. I always seem to have a series of miracles rain down on me. And at that time, it was about $7 million to renovate this building, and they needed it in 6 months. And I found a miracle banker at NBD who loaned me a $5 million construction loan, a $5 million perm loan after that, let me be the general contractor with no bond, remembering that I'm an auto mechanic at this time. And I sold $1 million worth of tax credits, meaning I filled out 60 sheets of paper that I gave to Comerica Bank, and they gave me $1 million in cash to use towards the construction. That's one of the benefits of the tax credits you see and hear in the news so much these days. So put all that together, and for the next 8 years, there were 1,100 students in that school every day. People were complaining that I created a traffic jam.
And the man bought it for $1,000. And I think, Landy, for a long time, they were paying you rent of $65,000 a month.
They were. That was one of the great stories when people from New York, New York or Chicago who we knew were going to come and want to build here, I would tell them, yeah, I bought this building for $1,000 and I get $65,400 a month rent.
Anything is possible. And I'm Jack Brasula, and we're with Joel Landy. And this is Anything is Possible, a News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Brasula. This is Anything is Possible. We're talking to Joel Landy, who's a tall, hippie version of Einstein. And he looks like Einstein wishes he looked. Joel, another building, the Addison on Woodward in Charlotte. There used to be the Atlas restaurant on the ground floor. Now it's the Faux Lucky restaurant. What are you doing with that building?
That's been a long, interesting story. Built in 1905 as a 50-unit residence hotel. Later, 1914, Albert Kahn built an addition on what is now the parking lot, tied them together with bridges, and it became a 400-room hotel. It's rumored the Purple Gang was headquartered in the Addison. It served a transient population. Originally, in all the buildings on Woodward, first there were big Victorian houses. As there were so many people, they tore those houses down and built stores to service those people. The Addison, when it changed to stores, they took the cafeteria out and built a drugstore. That's the drugstore that later was servicing the drug dealers in the tri-state area. It was full of junkies and prostitutes. And it was closed, and the building owner sold me the building for $60,000 because he didn't want to fix the roof anymore. And he thought me, looking like a hippie, as you've said a couple times, knew what he did and didn't care. I actually thought he only sold syringes, which I kept trying to get him to stop, and he didn't stop selling them. He had his employees come pick them up. He was in Florida. I faxed him a letter. I said, my wife is going to walk in the garden and step on a syringe and get AIDS and die from it. You must stop selling these. And as I said, he turned around and sent his employees to clean up my yard every day. So It was another 9 years. The Addison I used as a demonstration project, and it was a link. That area between Orchestra Hall and the Fox Theater was no man's land, a wasteland. Nothing was there. You drove as fast as you could to get through it. Building the Addison and having market-rate housing and the Atlas Restaurant, which was a Highline Gourmet restaurant, brought the little old ladies from Orchestra Hall to Charlotte and Woodward. Brought the theater goers and the sports fans to Charlotte and Woodward and started to fill in that link. Using the finance at the Addison as an example, I helped people in Brush Park across the street renovate condos and commercial buildings, and we started to develop a small part of the local economy right there. One of the very important things in the Addison, which with government, it does seem it's always years to get something done to move the elephant. This one was, again, 18 months. But out of the 40 apartments I built, I put in 5 low-income apartments. There's a talk in many cities all over the world that rich and poor people won't live together. And then there's this terrible word, gentrification, which I actually learned could be changed around to be controlled gentrification, which actually has a good effect. So I knew those same developers we were trying to bring in from New York, Chicago, wherever, bring your money and spend it in Detroit, we're going to have that idea that it's going to all be for rich people and we're going to make a lot of money. And it won't work any other way. So the Addison was a demonstration project to show that it would. It's been very successful, but in order to do it and to get it through the government, I had to change all the rules. The government in Detroit, fortunately, was very cooperative, and because it was in the empowerment zone, they would do less units, and because it was in a historic district, they'd allow the funding to come with different standards. And they put a lot of different pieces together to allow me to combine the low-income housing and the market-rate housing. And to this very day, it's perfect. And unless I said it here, I'm sure no one knows.
We're talking to Joel Landy, who currently owns 10% of Midtown. In August of 2012, Jack Lessenberry wrote an article about you. Quote, "The first time I saw Joel Landy, I wondered if he had had any trouble getting admitted to the restaurant he was sitting in." This was at Atlas, a swanky bistro on Woodward Avenue, where booming Midtown meets the Cass Quarter. Landy was quarter to the max. His hair was rumpled, his eyes were bleary, he was wearing a black T-shirt and some wrinkled pants that had seen better days, and he needed a shave. Joel, you do have to admit that you're a peach in an apple orchard. And you're proud of it.
Well, having said, I did rent the shirt I'm wearing today.
It's black, and it's seen better days. And that's being kind.
But that has served me very well. People have underestimated me over and over again. Oh, that guy can never do that. So that opens up the world to me, and I go and do it, and I'm the hero. So it serves me very well. It actually is part of my success. I think in the 60s I had long hair, so no one will hire you. Because no one would hire me, I had to have my own business. I had to create my own world where long hair didn't matter. And so I did that, and that certainly has been part of my success. So I guess all over my entire life, it's turned the negative into the positive.
We met through Alexander Zajac. And we had a breakfast, the three of us. And you show up, it's like 35 degrees, and you show up in this convertible, OMG, and you sit down at the table and you put down 2 keychains. And each chain had at least 100 keys. How do you know which key goes where?
Actually, on the first part of that, I have really learned and watched and seen that wealthy people don't carry that many keys. They have someone else to carry them for them. So I do long for that day. It will come. But I have a very good memory, and I have a few tricks.
A few. Okay. What's amazed you the most about downtown and Midtown these past 3-4 years?
Well, that's a hard question to answer. None of it amazed me because I guess that it actually did happen, but it's all the stuff that we've been working on and planning, and you could say dreaming, but it's a real dream. everything, the queue line and the quality housing and the mix of places to eat are all the things that we worked so hard to put here. So there are no surprises. It's exactly what we've been working on so hard for 40 years.
All right. Let's go forward another 10 years. 2027. Describe Midtown to us in 2027.
It will be more dense, for sure. The city government and other planners are talking about the fact that we're going to use less cars and a lot more people walking, so we don't have to build as many parking structures. I wish that was true. We're in Motor City, and everyone has to stop right at their front doorstep. But even more important than Midtown is, our current administration and civic leaders watched while we fixed Midtown. And they're using those same strategies throughout the city. So it's Midtown changes by its surroundings changing. When in my little area, I learned when I helped the guy across the street and freely helped him renovate the building, it made my property values double and my life so much better. So the changes in Midtown are going to have the rest of the city around us participating.
Quickly, Pastor Faith Fowler, a hero to you.
She is great. Before she came to the Methodist Church, it was a problem institution. They ran a homeless shelter, but the management was poor. The people were on the street and not properly taken care of, and they had no pride, and the services were limited. You can't bring someone in, give them a cup of coffee, and then throw them back on the street. It's no way to treat a human being, aside from saying you're trying to help them. Faith Fowler has a real understanding of human nature and all the rest of it, economics and housing and all of the pieces that she needed to be successful. And anything can exist anywhere as long as they're a good neighbor. And she has turned it into being a good neighbor. And truthfully, we don't know those same institutions are still there, but they are.
Joel Landy? You are a shining example of with God anything is possible. Someday there's going to be a statue of you in Midtown. Keep up the great work.
Thank you.
Please join us next Saturday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spall.